Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 70, section 10, which is old single column, page 794. Okay, the important thing to have in mind is just what was immediately given to us in the preceding section, in section 9 there on human rights. Remember, they made a point, they even italicized it in that paragraph that's right after the list of 10 there in that paragraph. They italicized natural rights. We have the parallel fact to that that they'll be bringing up immediately in this section. So I'll touch back on that, but just recall that they were, they were bringing up that issue of, basically there's very few things that are genuinely natural rights. By and large, when we're talking about our rights that we claim in our societies, it's the definitive elements of the mores system that we're referring to. And that mores system is an evolutionary phenomenon. And recall how they were stressing that. So these two sections are very much parallel, and they're just picking up and telling the rest of the story about that very much evolutionary phenomenon of the mores, and after it's gone for a very long time, it begins to be thought of as just innate, and humans forget that they were the authors of those so-called rights. Okay, so let's just jump in, and we'll see what they say here about justice.
Section 10, Evolution of Justice. Natural justice is a man-made theory. It is not a reality. In nature, justice is purely theoretic, wholly a fiction. Nature provides but one kind of justice, inevitable conformity of results to cause.
To causes. Okay, so let's take that final sentence first. Because that's very, very important. It seems like a relatively limited statement, perhaps in this context, and you're thinking just material, or physical causality. But remember, the entirety of all deity and reality is innately logical, is innately causal. There is not one element of magic, one iota of magic anywhere. It's entirely logical, entirely causal. Your beginning way of coming to terms with that causality in relationship to your universal father, your spiritual father, is to think of the universal father as the first source and center of all things and beings. The uncaused cause, the first cause. Okay. When you see them referring to causality, always remind yourself of, it's a specific statement of a universal generality. And it's very important to challenge yourself to make that step, a step that humans have never challenged themselves holistically to make. There's always some area that they've given an exception to. There's causality here, but over there be magic. The Lord works in mysterious ways, or whatever. Okay. Beyond here be dragons, and you're drawing an old map. So just because there's mystery, don't bring in magic. Know that behind the veil of mystery it's pure logical causal reality. Okay. Now, to the point I was teasing at the beginning, see how they're bringing in the parallel here to natural rights with natural justice. Right? It's not a reality, they say. Again, it's a human construct, and a human labeling. And the parallels are like at the beginning of section 9. It says nature confers no rights on man, only life and a world in which to live it. Remember that? We were reminding ourselves of the Declaration of Independence for the United States, picking up on that. And that unalienable right of life, right? Because obviously can't be taken away. It's given by nature. It's just innately there. And then also they said, right after that list of 10, where they italicized natural rights, when rights are old beyond knowledge of origin, they are often called natural rights. Okay. So you have the exact same thing in parallel with justice. So right up front, we also need to remind ourselves of the basic sense that you're invoking when you use the word justice or when you use the word just. We're talking about law abiding. Now, initially, you don't have quote unquote laws, but you have a mores system, right? So conformity to those societal norms, those mores. And especially, when you're bringing in justice, as you might guess, it's the part of the mores system that's where the taboos are. Those taboos are what is going to pass for laws, to begin with. The very, very hard, fast, elements. Yep.
So, how does this coincide with, like, karma, or you reap what you sow, or you'll get yours down the road?
What goes around comes around.
One sometimes calls, natural justice. I mean, it's you know what I'm asking?
Yes.
It's not nature necessarily, but.
But
it's different, right?
But think about, what's behind those things, like what goes around comes around, and or concepts of karma and whatnot. It's inherent in the fact that it's a indelibly logical causal reality. You can pretend that you aren't subject to the rigors of fact only so long. And humans, even when they didn't have a solid philosophic understanding like I'm just describing, they noticed experientially that this is the way it works. And they would have rationalized it as an all-seeing spirit world that saw to it that you got your just desserts, right? Perhaps, but nonetheless, see, it's actually predicated in the fact that you can't escape the fact that you are part of a system with laws,
which is different than nature justice they're talking about here, so to speak.
When humans say natural justice, they're not thinking about causality, right? Of a logical reality, it's just like natural justice? The parallel when rights are old beyond knowledge of origin, they are often called natural rights. See when a mode of justice, right, is old beyond knowledge of origin, right, is often called natural justice. That it just We begin to think of, and even when you bring in God, God's the author of nature, like I mentioned before. So, see, it's just God's law. Because it's so old, you forget that humans were the author of it, and you think it just comes out of the existential fact of reality and is imposed upon you as natural justice. Okay. But they're just trying to remind you that in terms of natural, we have causality, and with the rights, you have life. Oh, and a world on which to live it, right? But in terms of just yourself, you have you're subject inescapably to the rigors of causality, to the law of causality, and you are given life by a process that's beyond human tinkering. Right? So it's just there. Okay, and like you said, the next paragraph brings in the parallel directly here that I'm alluding to.
Justice, as conceived by man, means getting one's rights, and has therefore been a matter of progressive evolution. The concept of justice may well be constitutive in the spirit-endowed mind, but it does not spring full-fledgedly into existence on the worlds of space.
Okay, so see, justice as conceived by man means getting one's rights. So there you see, I'm directly speaking to this parallel. When you think about the levels of meaning, where just fits in, first just, next fair, then patient. when you're in a very immature state, your relationship to the levels of meaning starts out in this very self-centered mode. The first level of meaning is the level of selfishness, and so you have this very self-centered concept of justice that they're alluding to there. I demand my rights. That's the initial sense. You really don't care about anyone else. It's all about you and your rights, getting one's rights, like they're saying there. And so when you see a very immature individual, that's in one way or another, you know that that's what they're publicly screaming for, is their rights. They demand justice.
Like my five-year-old
grandson. Right. Right. And notice that what it says there, the concept of justice may well be constitutive in a spirit-endowed mind. Okay. There has to be a little bit of reflection. An animal doesn't have the word justice in its vocabulary. Right? And you can see that tiny little bit of genuine personal nature, unreflective, but still there, in just the sentence I was just saying, I demand my rights, right? There's a self-aware self there that's using the I pronoun. That's the foundation of your recognition of your humanity is to use the capital I pronoun and declare that you're a self-aware self, that you are an ego in Latin, right? And then declare how things appear from this initial very self-centered recognition of oneself. And the universe should all be orbiting about you, and you demand your rights. Okay, so yes, the concept of justice may well be constitutive in a spirit-endowed mind. You notice they didn't, they left a little bit of fuzziness there, because one can be quite clueless and thinking in animal-like fashion. But it does not spring full-fledgedly into existence on the worlds of space. So, I mean, even if you do have the beginnings, like I was just expressing, there's not going to be basically any degree of objectivity to the your initial concept of justice. It's going to be very subjective, very self-centered. You know, like we often talk about, truth is, you know, what I think, falsehood's what you think. You know, this is the way, you know, this is where everyone starts. You know, it's all, you know, everything is defined relative to you. You know, I have fact, you have figment. I have truth, you have falsehood. You know, on and on and on and on, like that, in that relativity. But it's, but again, remember the caveat. I mean, if selfishness, you know, starting in selfishness was innately bad, it wouldn't exist. It's obviously God's way. It's obviously good as a starting point. You have to start by taking a hold of your self-awareness and then learning to do something productive with that self-awareness. Because there's, until you're a self-aware self, there's no means for personality to begin to manifest within you. Beyond that, you know, that's the initiating step. The father gives you the capital I pronoun. And then the mother leads you from that starting point. I am, okay, now what? The father has nothing to do with the now what. You know, despite the fact that humans have always rationalized, it had everything to do with the now what. No, he's delegated the rest of it to the mother. Right? The father's just the initiator. So this whole evolutionary process that they're, you know, and they said it's been a matter of progressive evolution, right? I mean, who's the author of evolution? It's God the Mother, not God the Father. So you're getting into that whole process of what the individuality of the whole is doing to evolve the system forward. Okay, and so yeah, you know, these are tiny little paragraphs, but it's important to kind of stress all the details in them to begin with. You know, I mean, they're packing them with a lot of stuff between the lines, you know, but it does not spring full-fledgedly, you know, oh yeah, understatement, right? You know, that challenge for humility that they're putting between the lines there. And you go, well, I'm spiritually conscious. You know, when they say spirit-endowed mind, you go, oh, that's talking about me. I'm spiritually conscious, and I'm innately divine. And so I'm the exception. It's full-fledgedly in my mind. Now, you may not be so prideful that you literally say that out loud like I just did, but you're going to say it unconsciously, and you need to catch yourself saying it unconsciously and not let that happen. You know, you've got to drag all that unconscious stuff that has those unfortunate, selfish, or self-centered modes to begin with, and, you know, and get it out in the light and expose it to some disinfection. Okay, what else did I say here?
Primitive man assigned all phenomena to a person. In case of death, the savage asked not what killed him, but who. Accidental murder was not therefore recognized. And in the punishment of crime, the motive of the criminal was wholly disregarded. Judgment was rendered in accordance with the injury done.
Okay. So you see, now they're transitioning into the historical story. Yes, it's a historical story, but it's also your developmental story. You know, if mankind began there, you began there as an individual. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Now, that's always in play. The development of you as an individual you know, goes through the bullet points of the evolutionary process, to say it in, you know, common parlance, what I, you know, that expression of ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. You must go through this, the headings of the sections of evolutionary history. You know, you have to go through it in essence. And so think about that as you start out. You can't abstract enough, you know, yet, and so you blame it on an individual. Who did it?
Or God.
Right, right, and, you know, it may end up being that individual, the individual, you know, who gets the blame, right? But it has to be a who, right? It couldn't be, well, that's just the law of causality. Oh, no, there is no such thing. You know, you aren't abstract enough to recognize that. Everything is ruled by causality. And so, you know, you want to point at someone. If you can't find a convenient human, maybe you do just that. Maybe you point to the heavens and blame God for it. You know, why is God making me suffer like this?
Remember when Jesus was talking about seeing people suffer because of the faults of his trusted sons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Well, obviously, the Prince Caligas and Adam and so on and so forth. Remember, they talked about that. So, in other words, here again, putting the blame on the who, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Yeah, and that's a great example to bring up. I often inject that when it comes up. You know, when you first read the Urantia book, one of the things that you take away from it is, oh, I've got some new who's that I can conveniently blame for all of my difficulties. It's that Caligastia guy and Adam and Eve. You know, my life's troubles are all their fault. Again, of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. Okay, did he live it blaming Caligastia and Adam and Eve for all of his difficulties?
No.
Is that the example he set for you? If you think so, you need to read part four again. It's like, well, I've read it 100 times. Well, you need to read it again. And it hasn't sunk in. The truth hasn't sunk in yet.
I didn't mean to say that.
No.
You know, if I recall it, it's more like he feels sorry for the fact that happened.
Yes. Yeah. I was just going to come back around to your comment there. You know, I often bring up that, you know, don't be too quick to blame. A lot of things don't have anything to do with Prince Caligas, you know, the rebellion or the default. They're on every world. Like, war is on every world, for instance. There's nothing to do with rebellion and default. And then besides that, you have free will. You don't have to be a helpless victim of antecedent causation, like rebellion and default. Nonetheless, you can, I mean, Michael can look at the circumstance and say, "Yeah, wow, boy, did they get a tough draw, you know, in the hand of life." You know, yes, that is the case. But to him whom much is given is much expected, right? I mean, to think about that in a different way, you know, instead of just you've been given lots of positive stuff, if you've given lots of negative stuff, you know, technically even more is expected of you now. You need to make lemonade out of those lemons. You need to rise to the challenge of being an agadoner. So
that's right. What does he do with that? I mean, he can take it to a place where he has compassion, but if he took it to a place where circumstances, they're just hopeless. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not going to do us any good. You know, if you've had a tough draw, as you call
mm-hmm.
it,
mm-hmm.
well, if it's not going to make it better if we're just allowed to feel sorry for ourselves. And,
right, of course not. Yeah. And in our better moments, we know that. Because humans figured out a long time ago, if nothing else. But again, you know, here again, we're remember what we're fundamentally doing. We're looking at the facts of history spread out before us, and recognizing the thread of truth that flows through that. You know, that same thread of truth is what you are following along as you develop. So, I mean, that's where the immediate value of what we're reading always lies, in recognizing how this applies to you, what your initial challenges are. Catch yourself. Am I still in the mode, you could ask yourself? Or instead of asking what, I'm asking who? You know, I'm always bringing in a conspiracy theory, right? There must be a who or whos, you know, that are behind all this. I mean, see, just think about how popular conspiracy theories are. Okay, so in other words, that's primitive man doing what the very most primitive man has always done. It does on every world. The other thing in there, they use the word motive. See, and in the punishment of crime, the motive of the criminal was wholly disregarded. Remember, motive is a spirit word, your spiritual motive. And initially, you don't have a lot of insight. You just have no ability to penetrate deep into an individual and recognize the genuine motive. However, you still use that word, but you'll apply it to superficial facts, you know, to outer life things, not a genuine inner life fact. Right? So that's what they're saying. Judgment was rendered in accordance with the injury done. So you have humans enough, they're primitive men, right? They have the capital I pronoun. They have the word justice, but they don't, they rationalize all of those concepts, you know, basically in flatland, right? Or if you will, or on the surface of their fellow men, you know, and not by what's inside. And, you know, judgment rendered in accordance with the injury done. Oh, sounds like eye for an eye, does it not? Right. See, that's all, and that's all a primitive man can do, because they don't have the insight to penetrate or to think abstractly enough to go beyond that. It has to all be very concrete, you know, tangible, external, visible. You know, so
that's like insight for an eye, right?
Yeah. So, just, you know, and anyone who's been a parent should be able to reflect back and see their child beginning in those stages, and you're, as a parent, just trying to set an example to establish an environment that will foster that child continuing to grow. You don't try to drag them out of that. You don't demonize them for being in that stage. They begin in that stage, but you're trying to foster the growth, the favorable conditions for them to be grown through that. You know, so be gentle on yourself as well, but supply some favorable conditions so that, and eventually you'll look back and go, oh, you know, I don't have a tendency, a knee-jerk tendency to point to some individual for my problems. You know, I'm hungry. You know, it's your fault for not feeding me. You know, or whatever. All right, let's keep going.
In the earliest primitive society, public opinion operated directly. Officers of law were not needed. There was no privacy in primitive life. A man's neighbors were responsible for his conduct. Therefore, their right to pry into his personal affairs. Society was regulated on the theory that the group membership should have an interest in and some degree of control over the behavior of each individual.
Okay, so something between the lines there is again, there's a limit to the definitive individuality consciousness that primitive people have. Remember, they start out in the horde, right? So it's all just sort of one gray homogeneous soup that everyone is in, right? So some of the things that come naturally with that is everyone knows what everyone else is doing. And how that fits into the justice, you can obviously, you know, there's this, everyone is very superstitious. There's all of these very fearful taboos. And everyone is in a collective state of trying to make sure that taboos don't get violated, lest there's calamity for all. Because they believe that the punishment is severe and sweeping for the violation of a taboo. You know, it won't just be Bob over there that gets snuffed out. We're all going to die. Right? So there's this collective mentality to pry into everyone else. But, you know, naturally, no one really cares if everyone is prying into your life. You don't have this need for privacy sense. You think of yourself in a very animal-like collective mode. Yeah. Mankind fell back into a lot of that to a large degree during the Middle Ages. Everyone, big group of people will all be living in one big lodge, you know, and it's all just open. And everyone's just doing what we all do, right? You know, in the midst of everyone else. It's like we were, you know, a bunch of cows in a corral. We're just trying to push our way up out of these levels, you know, in recent centuries here. Okay, let's see, anything else there? No, let's keep going.
It was very early believed that ghosts administer justice through the medicine men and priests. This constituted these orders the first crime detectors and officers of the law. Their early methods of detecting crime consisted in conducting ordeals of poison, fire, and pain. These savage ordeals were nothing more than crude techniques of arbitration. They did not necessarily settle a dispute.
Settle a dispute.
Justly.
Justly.
Yeah. For example, when poison was administered, if the accused vomited, he was innocent.
If he died, he was killed.
Right. And so again, we chuckle, but remember, I mean, what's the mode there? I mean, you believe that there's a natural justice in play, right? It's just inherent. I mean, you can have a full-blown God concept to the limit of your abilities, you know, back then. But, you know, you're thinking that God is just, you know, he set up nature in this sort of vast conspiracy to, you know, that he won't be mocked, you know, and you must obey. And all you have to do is just subject someone to God's judgment, subject them to nature, and God sorts it out. Nature is just the hand of God, so that poison is just the hand of God, and it will either kill or not kill, depending on whether the person is guilty or innocent. Okay, it's natural justice. It's God's justice through the natural things like poison that He created. That is the way they're thinking about it. And again, you see there, it was very early believed that ghosts administer justice. Initially you may not have God, like you're saying, but it's the spirit world doing the same thing. I was just, the same role that I had God playing there in the story. And it's because of that intangible, mysterious, fearful spirit world, you know, that you have the power of taboos. And you don't need police forces. Everyone is very sober about this stuff, self-regulates, you know, very earnestly, and tries to help everyone else to self-regulate, like we were just saying. Right? Everyone has to stay between the lines, stay on the straight and narrow.
Chris?
Yep?
We don't have self-regulation happening much around us.
Yeah, because we're in that difficult.
It's like the opposite is happening.
Yeah, we're in that difficult. Yeah, it is the opposite. We're in that difficult adolescent transition stage where we're just sophisticated enough of mind to recognize how silly and superstitious these old modes were. You know, like there's taboo. You know, administered by ghosts. Right, the justice of which is administered by ghosts. Yeah, yeah. So you get sophisticated enough that you don't believe that. You know, call that foolishness. But what have you replaced it with?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I'm kind of wishing yeah. we had taboos.
Right.
I really do wish
right.
that.
There would be a lot. It'd be a lot more peaceful place if taboos still ruled. Right?
Mm-hmm. But that was a sheltered pig.
Right. Yeah. But see, we don't have that option.
Right.
Well, eventually,
you
replace it with law.
Right. Well, you certainly replace it with law, but you know there has to be some, you know, moral desire to conform to the law. Right. See, and again,
it's not just the threat of jail and stuff like that. It's a desire.
In your heart. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it definitely has to be written in your heart. The law has to be written in your heart. Right. But just, I mean, again. You think about, I mean, first of all, the individual has to be sophisticated enough to have some relationship to law as a literal fact, that abstract thing of law, right? It's not something that you can touch, and it's not something you can believe that you could touch if you had, you know, if you could touch ghosts or spirits, right? So, I mean, it has to go beyond that literalness. You know, and your willingness to submit yourself to that abstraction,
morals.
Right? Yeah, not to mention eventually developing general moral consciousness, which is the law written in your heart, right? You know, but you know, historically, you know, moral has just been about conformity to the mores, not to the cosmos. So it wasn't genuine morality. It was just conformity to the mores system that we call morality. You know, especially we use that word morality historically when we're talking about the part of the mores system that's the really scary part, the taboos. In a tribal mode, even if you're like we are in the United States today, we still have effectively taboos in our mores system. It can rise up, you know, kind of unexpectedly. All of a sudden, everyone is like really fixated, and they can't find strong enough language to talk about how horrible it is that someone did such and so, i.e., violated what we consider a taboo. And you cannot do that. And this, when you get into the mode we are now, where we can change more rapidly, and yet we still can be very absolutist about certain elements of the mores system, effectively think of them as taboos, you know, what was just fine a few decades ago, you know, all of a sudden, you know, in your lifetime, is now being called a taboo, you know, and then if you violate, you should just be excoriated, you know, if not executed. And it's like, well, wait a minute, it was totally fine when I was young. What are you saying? Right? I mean, it's hard for us, you know, the ancients, you know, taboos might change, you know, every 10,000 years or something, yeah, but now they, you know, we can, these absolutist mores elements, you know, we'll change them in the span of a human's life. Here, that's so we have to think about the fairness of this. I mean, you can't expect someone who basically hardwired their brain when they were young in an old mores system to just naturally conform to this new one that you've invented, you know, that you now think is the word of God, and to violate it is an abomination. I mean, you know, so, you know, and we all know that the, you know, the touchiest elements of this are where we tend to use morality, you know, what are effectively taboos in the mores system, the stuff related to sex and marriage, things like that. You know, that's where people get really riled up about the, you know, about things. So, so again, you know, back up into this. You know, just you know, what people think are their rights. You know, I have a right to behave that way. You know, and then the next day, no, you don't have a right to that way. And justice demands that you die. So how that right, you know, your rights and what natural justice demands, how that, you know, can shift really rapidly now. Okay, but now the other element there, the key thing, you notice is that the savage ordeals were nothing more than crude techniques of arbitration. Again, objective justice is way too abstract for primitive people. It's basically too abstract for most people alive today as well. But, you know, and so rather than, you know, trying to go through some difficult process of finding that abstraction, that objective justice that you may not even be able to consciousize the sense of, you got two people, they're at loggerheads, you point to a third person and say, okay, you know, flip a coin, you know, and tell us which one wins. You know, that third person, you know, is what you mean by arbitration, bringing in a third person and, you know, to resolve an argument. And early on, when all you're doing is demanding justice, you haven't gotten up to that little kid that instead of saying, you know, I demand justice, you know, next he says, that's not fair. You know, before the people get to the point where they will, you know, clamor that this ruling from this arbiter is not fair, well, you just accept it, you know? And again, because it's so natural, it's like, well, what if all he did is flip a coin? Well, the spirits or God is in control of the coin, right? Just like the poison, right? And the coin will come down heads if you're supposed to win and tails if you're not supposed to win. And that's just God's judgment through the coin.
According to your insurance policy, every tornado that damaged your house was an act of God.
Right, right.
Someone had to go down.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, you know, if you're familiar with the Bible at all, you know, or even other, you know, old writings, they may not have flipped a coin, but what did they do? That's the same thing. What was the favorite way?
Drawing straws.
Drawing straws, yes, right. Right? See, again, that's natural justice. That's God or the spirits, you know, seeing to it that the person that is supposed to draw the short straw draws the short straw, right? You know, it's fated,
yeah.
Right?
That's how they replaced Judas in the 12 apostles.
Yeah.
And whoever they chose, nobody ever heard of again.
Right. Right. Yeah. But again, see that, you know, think about how, you know, how do we decide who's going to kick off in the football game or whatever? I mean, we still are letting, you know, natural justice decide some of these things. Okay, with the coin toss.
Well, remember when Jesus was counseling the guy who was condemned to death?
You know, mm-hmm. Said, right.
You know, the state has the right, you be the judge, but there is a judge who will look at your motives, you know.
Right.
And that's the difference, I think, what they're talking about here, being we're not in that kind of situation where we really are understanding the depth of a situation to be able to judge that correctly.
Yeah, and even now, right, I mean, it's going to be very difficult to judge people based on their genuine motives. I mean, those aren't that apparent. Right? They may not even be that apparent to the individual who committed the crime, right? So, you know, perforce, we have to just do our best to do it with as much fairness and objectivity as possible. And then what does it, again, say in part four? That which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. Because, you know, in the big picture, as they're just saying, this is all a man-made theory. It's not a reality, right? we may think that we have to get this exactly right, because if we don't, you know, we're damning ourselves for violating God's law. But no, it's just an evolutionary process, and it's just we need some way of dealing with the tensions amongst us, come up with some way, and then move on. Later, you know, later on in evolution, you'll have a different way. It may not necessarily be a better way. You know, in many ways, there isn't a better way, you know, until you get way far down the road in objectivity. Just everyone needs to agree on what the rules are and submit to them, and we chug along. Right? If we all agree that the coin rules, you know, the initiation, you know, war doesn't break out. You know, we all submit to that, and on we go. That's just, you know, they're trying to remind us that a lot of our justice system is just a way of having some sort of an arbitration of it. Some decision is made, and we can move on, because we can't stick in that argument forever. You have to just draw a line and move on. Right? You know, and you won't, if the more you, more spiritually conscious that get, the harder it is for you to do that. Because the more you start thinking, no, there's some absolute right and wrong here, and we have to find it, you know, and if we have to stay arguing about this for all time, we're going to do it. You're just short-circuiting your growth. Yeah, you have to be willing to just accept things and move on. All right. Now they give us an example that's even more delightful, one might say, than the poison example here.
The Old Testament records one of these ordeals, a marital guilt test. If a man suspected his wife of being untrue to him, he took her to the priest and stated his suspicions, after which the priest would prepare a concoction consisting of holy water and sweepings from the temple floor. After due ceremony, including threatening curses, the accused wife was made to drink the nasty potion. If she was guilty, quote, the water that causes the curse shall enter into her and become bitter, and her belly shall swell, and her thighs shall rot, and the woman shall be accursed among her people. Unquote. If by any chance any woman could quaff this filthy draught and not show symptoms of physical illness, she was acquitted of the charges made by her jealous husband.
We're not used to spelling draft like that, but see, you have quaff this filthy draught. Yeah. It's a Melchizedek, isn't it? Right? Yeah, the Melchizedek is having fun there. Just the play on the words there, with the European A there, quaff this filthy draught.
Guess we could just throw up really quick and probably get a pass on that one.
I went to that first because you got this really kind of politically incorrect, prickly sort of example here in play. Notice, so the revelator actually threw in a little funny there, just to kind of try to lighten it a little bit so that you don't take it too seriously by using that little play on words there. It's just tempted a little levity in the midst of, don't get all worked up here now. Just the way it is in the evolutionary process that we think in primitive terms like this. But again, they don't think of it as primitive, right? They think of it as the height of humility and submission to natural justice, to God's judgment, right? I mean, you're being very earnest about making sure that everything involved is as holy and sacred as possible, right? It's holy water, and it's a sacred sweepings from the sacred temple, and it's like, you know, God is just permeating, you know, everything that's in play. You know, the priest is doing it, etc.
So okay. I wonder what they did if the woman thought her husband was being unfaithful.
Yeah, well, there's an issue with, you know, this being fair in both directions. Yes, we all know that.
Just give him a beer and see how it goes.
Yeah, remember, it was a long time before women weren't just basically property, you know. But do notice again just how existentialized, how absolutist it is. A man suspected his wife of being untrue to him. It's like, you know, see, as if this is this has sweeping connectivity to the whole, you know, and it isn't just some arbitrary little meaningless thing, you know, between two fancy animals, right? No, this is untrue, or, you know, all right, see, everything is aggrandized list. But again, they basically had very little sense of free will. They all sort of saw themselves as just kind of plugged into God's micromanagement system. And the only place that free will fits into that, in those primitive senses, is you breaking out of the micromanaged system and then deserving death by the God of vengeance.
And this still happens today in some Middle East countries.
Right? Yeah.
Where they stone.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah. I mean, and we all know that, you know, this is not history. This is present day in many ways, these sorts of ideas. Yes. Okay, but just, see, notice the little things that are slipped in. In the midst of, you know, quickly, you know, in a thumbnail sketch, telling you that story from the Old Testament. I think that's in the Book of Numbers, if I remember correctly. You can go look that up, that the whole story as it's told there. You know, I mean, obviously, the basic facts are what's in the Old Testament. So the point isn't just to retell you that. If that was the point, they could have just said, go read, you know, such and so chapter in the Book of Numbers. Right. So look for the little things that are thrown in there to try to, you know, get you into the space where you understand where those people were and hence where you will tend to be at a certain stage of your development. And all of it is, you know, in many ways, it's just that early stage where you're going to have a natural tendency to think of everything as natural. Right? Do we not have a fixation with the word natural in recent times? And so it just, you know, it's a part of our developmental process as individuals and as a group where, you know, even when you throw out God or ghosts or spirits or whatever, you just basically make material nature itself effectively this perfect divine fact that you must conform to. You know, it's magic matter, you know, basically. It's no longer even something that has a spirit in it. You know, it just is this magical, mystical fact, you know, that you revere every time you use the word natural, right?
And all natural, in case that's...
I mean, if you need to stress, it is all natural, it is pure, see, right? That purity thing, because it is a religion. But now, of course, you know, it doesn't mean that there isn't some material pragmatism, you know, elements here that are important, but you notice the problem. It isn't staying with the material pragmatism. It's immediately, you know, becoming your idealism, and it's not true idealism because it's material idealism, right? And you're using all these spirit words or religious words talking about stuff, material stuff, right? Purity and, you know, things like this, right?
Natural.
I'm saying the things that you bring in. You know,
But still, the material creation is part of the mother's way.
Yeah.
And we should respect and not desecrate mother.
Yeah, of course. Like I said, that's the challenge, is to not think you know, don't respond to what I was just saying in a dichotomy. I'm not, right? But just appreciate material pragmatism is separate from spiritual idealism. Right? Don't let them blur together. There's a material phase of reality that needs all sorts of consideration and respect. But it's, you know, no matter how much you respect the material creation, it still is not spirit substance.
No.
That's just so important to not, you know.
I'm not saying to worship it.
Yeah.
I tend to like the mother's material creation.
Yeah. The trick is to just not let yourself bring in reverence, you know. For the matter itself, right? I mean, go through to the author of creation. You know, the existential author, the Father, or the immediate experiential author, the Mother. But go through to the author. And don't start reverencing the stuff itself. Because again, that's the whole natural. That's, you know, on the religious side, you know, what parallels what we're reading is that, you know, reverencing, venerating rocks and hills and, you know, and heavenly bodies and animals and plants and, you know, all this natural stuff.
Yeah, the New Age really. I have a lot of that.
Right.
We could have an enlightened relationship with pragmatism and really be quite in sync with it all and have those boundaries, you know, functionally established.
You may notice that I do, you know, as long as you say material pragmatism, I'm allowing that ism suffix there. Okay? See? There is, you know, the essence of what Terry was just bringing up, there is something of the whole there, right? You know, it's the material phase of the whole. But it's just, you know, it's just, you have to be very careful to not mix the two. You know, you corrupt it both directions.
Are we it seems like we're probably in a dangerous state right now because most folks don't understand what, or no, who is divine.
Yeah.
A lot of things that we interact with each day. And so we instead of, you know, seeing them and understanding what's behind them or who's behind them, we're just stopping at you know, being real short-sighted.
Right. Yeah. Again, like the thing about the motive, you know. Again, if you don't have insight, right, you can't penetrate to those things. You know, you're just you're just judging everything on its surface.
So training and learning more about what's behind these things could be really helpful.
Really helpful. Yeah, it's just to coin a phrase. It's just it's so difficult for us to do that in the first place, and then when no one is in, you know, when the society is not encouraging people to move beyond those initial appearances to the reality that you can only get to via insight, right? Of course, it basically never happens, right? Because you can't get from appearance to reality naturally, right? That's a personality effort. It's a result of choice. And a choice that leads to effort, struggle, conflict, etc. It doesn't just fall into your mind that you approach things more objectively. Okay, let's see. I think we got everything there basically. Let's keep going.
These atrocious methods of crime detection were practiced by almost all the evolving tribes at one time or another. Dueling is a modern survival of the trial by ordeal.
So they throw in that little footnote to that, the preceding paragraph, you know, lest you, you know, pick on the Old Testament Hebrews too much. And it's just what I was saying. I mean, as I was saying there directly, it's general to peoples all over the world, and it's general to every one of you as an individual in your development.
Yep. Well, and in practice, these duels, they're not like the Westerns.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's the quick draw, right. Wins. No, they would stand back to back and walk a certain number of paces. Then they'd turn around, they'd both point at one another and shoot.
Mm-hmm.
It just, I mean, it's an ordeal. I mean, who's
just duel with guns.
Yeah, and also, you know, they might, one might just, you know, if he knew the other guy was a better shot, he might just stand there and take the first shot, you know, think, I'm tough enough to survive it, you know, and then fire himself and kill the other guy, you know, and live to tell the tale. Yeah.
That's Andrew Jackson.
Andrew Jackson, yeah.
Name that ordeal.
The
floor sweepings, there was like five other women in there that week. So that last one, she kind of got
it. My hero, Alexander Hamilton, was killed in a duel by that dastardly. That low life.
Yeah, many write him as a low life because of that duel. Yes, and he needs to be lifted up in history again, not just judged by that one duel. But again, you know, you may not have thought about that. See, that's why they put it in here. You know, have you thought about the fact that no matter how much it seemed like it was just a, you know, two pugnacious guys, you know, having at each other? No, behind it is this sense of God is going to see to it that the person that should die dies. Right? They were submitting themselves to God's judgment. They weren't just trying to kill each other. Right? That's, you know, and you may not have thought about that. That's the point of that. Right? Is to, you know, so there's a humility in all these things. You know, all these ordeals and stuff, there's a favorable condition there of humility. Humbly submitting yourself to just be judged by the spirits or by God through some physical process that you just open yourself up to.
Their motivation here was pure.
Yeah, you know that if you're the one laying there dying after the duel, God judged you to be the one that needed to die, and you accepted that. It's like, you know, you actually, you know, felt a, you know, a sense of closeness to God, you know, in your judgment. At least I'm close enough to God to be judged by Him. Right? And you accepted your death. Yeah, they're I'm saying that because they're kind of building up to that part of the story here. Okay, so. Yeah, so just, you know, the natural thing is natural. I mean, everyone is going to be thinking in this natural justice, and that the powers that be are working through these natural processes. You know, that's just, and so just notice that you'll have a tendency to think that way too. That that basically the fates are ruling as they should in your life. That's an initial thought that you will naturally have. Right?
It is not to be wondered that the Hebrews and other semi-civilized tribes practiced such primitive techniques of justice administration 3,000 years ago. But it is most amazing that thinking men would subsequently retain such a relic of barbarism within the pages of a collection of sacred writings. Reflective thinking should make it clear that no divine being ever gave mortal man such unfair instructions regarding the detection and adjudication of suspected marital unfaithfulness.
Okay, so notice the challenge. See, so, I mean, yes, you've got a religious impulse, but you haven't even begun to follow your philosophic impulse. up into a domain of reflective thinking where it's trivially self-evident that God would not be the author of such foolishness, you know, such subjective arbitrariness.
But that's the God that we know, that relatives know. But the God of ancient times,
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I was about to comment on. I mean, so, you know, notice what else they're saying in there. You know, it is not to be wondered, right, to the Hebrews and others, right, because they're not capable of very much reflective thinking way back. But the mind energy system has been evolving, okay, and it was, you know, began to show its very definitive signs of moving us all collectively forward. A few centuries ago, you know, as we came out of the Middle Ages, right? Things have been manifesting in our civilized activity that show that the mind energy system that's engaging us is achieving better engagement. So we have more potential to think reflectively now than we did before. But it's sad to record that so few persons. See, again, why does it say it's sad to record? Because it's not sad to record that these people 3,000 years ago thought like this. They couldn't think any better than that. But it's sad to record that people are willfully blind now. There's none so blind as those who will not see. They're reminding you that in the name of religion, you are bonding yourself indelibly to these ancient modes of unreflective thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, he made it very clear, but I can still read this with a but. Mm-hmm. But how are we supposed to detect and adjudicate suspected marital unfaithfulness?
Private detective.
Well, again, obviously, you know, when you don't just put yourself in the hands of the infinite wisdom of God acting through the material elements, you're going to have wisdom yourself. Right? And how do you get wisdom? Well, it begins by reflective thinking, by developing insight. And wisdom results from the application of that insight to experience, not to mention foresight. Right? Getting into a human mode of where you can begin to penetrate the situation and recognize objectively what's going on, as opposed to saying, well, there's no way any of us could figure out anything objective. We're going to have to just turn it to the objective fact, to God, to sort out. You know, just kill them all and let God sort them out. You know, those sorts of thoughts. You know, we don't have the objectivity to figure this out ourselves, but we do. I mean, and that's the whole point of the fifth epical revelation. We must take delight in cultivating, getting this ability. You know, because between the lines of telling you, you know, you've always thought that God handles all this stuff through these material processes. No. God, especially God the Father, has nothing to do with any of this stuff. He has no relationship to time, let alone temple sweepings and marital infidelity. Right? And, you know, we have to take this up. We've always had to, you know, to take it up. And it's high time that we did, now that we have the potential to.
These guys were doing their best.
Yeah.
But you don't have an excuse.
Right. It's sad to record that so few persons are trying to do their best anymore. They're being satisfied with very simplistic, primitive modes of thought.
Most amazing.
Yes, but it is most amazing that, right, that thinking men, right?
Where is that meme coming from in Melchizedek? Most amazing. Probably don't use that term much, right?
If you want to think about experientially where it comes from, why he would say most amazing, mm-hmm. Why people come to this world as visitors and go, would you look at that? Would you look at that? I've never seen that before. Whoa. Okay, why is that? Because there's very few worlds that have as much spiritual consciousness as we do and so little precursor. Right? That we can think simple-mindedly and yet very energetically, spiritually energetically, like very few mortal worlds. Right? There's very few mortal worlds that have the kind of zeal for ignorance that we do. You know, oblivious, you know, ignorance.
So we're
show surprising willingness.
Yes, you show surprising willingness. It's most amazing. See, all those are talking about the same fact, that normally when you are that ignorant, you don't have that much, you know, self-animating energy in your mind, you know, that carries you off at these to these ridiculous slamming into the rails ends, like happens on this world. And so they come here to just watch us, watch the fancy animals go slamming into the walls all the time.
That's the popcorn, then.
Add something interesting to the Supreme
Law. Right, yeah.
That it's this crazy.
Right, the experience of hitting walls at high velocity is part of the total realm of experience.
It's different.
Right.
When I get back home, I'm going to let all the people I know check that
yeah.
out.
Remember on a normal world when we talk about, you know, how narrow the bell curve is? You know, so if you think of that bell curve as a velocity distribution, right, there aren't any high velocities or really mm-hmm. low velocities. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, I mean, it is very appropriate velocity. So if someone, you know, gets to the wall, you know, it's just a gentle little bounce off the wall. But in this world, we have this leading tail, you know, of energization, but the whole spectrum is ignorant, right? From end to end, it's hopelessly ignorant, okay? It's just different velocities.
There's the guy who will tie a JADO rocket on his car. How religious was that? And let himself off in the car.
There's lots of people that say it seemed like a good idea at the time, right?
You did hit the side of the mountain at 300.
But anyway, you get the point. We don't need to belabor it. But see that, you know, that's what's behind when they say things like it is most amazing. They, you know, they're just this Melchizedek has experiences with many worlds, and it's like, wow, I've never seen this before. You show a surprising willingness, right, relative to my billions and billions and billions of years of experience, I find your behavior surprising to me. You know, think about that. How many worlds he's seen, how many creatures he's seen, you know, over hundreds of billions of years, and he finds us surprising. It shows you how oddball this world is.
It's interesting you used the example of jealousy. Because it's hard to think of jealousy as having anything to do with spirit. But we wouldn't be jealous if we didn't have spirit. It's a very...
Not to mention, they don't bring it up here, but that's an important point, just a little aside. When you get to the marriage and family papers, they remind you that despite the fact that we think that jealousy is natural, it's not. It's wholly social. I mean, there's nothing genetic about that response. We adopt that and behave that way, not by nature, but by nurture. And that's a really tricky one. I mean, because it's so deep down, everyone is convinced, see, that it's natural. Just like they're saying here, when stuff is so far back in time, everyone's convinced it's natural. It's like, no, it's not nature, it's nurture. You know, the fact that jealousy is, you know, has nothing to do with something that is just sort of inescapably there by nature, like, say, you know, a fear response, you know, or something like that. So that, you know, that's a sobering thing to notice how sad it is that you've submitted yourself to that kind of a rule when it's not innate, you've imposed that on yourself.
And then you won't be able to tell the difference from whether it was natural or whether you just had a grip on something you didn't even know you had.
Yeah, not to mention, of course, that it's a poison that that debases you and makes it all the more difficult for you to ever achieve any objectivity.
Yeah. Short circuits everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. Just the one final thing before we go on. Notice how that ended. Suspected marital unfaithfulness, just like the untrue. Now we have the like true. We have faith. So again, you know, think about how we have these terms for this stuff. It's like, you know, wow, I never thought of marital unfaithfulness. Everyone says that. Does that have anything to do with faith? right. You know, it's like, well, yes and no, I suppose. Right? I mean, if there is something true, there is a faith issue at the nucleus of that truth, yes. And we kind of sense that superconsciously, but it does give you pause. It should give you pause when you see those words now. It's like, well, okay, but most of this is not what I'm getting by insight deep down in the inner life of these individuals. I'm just judging them on the surface like they told me we tend to do.
It helps me understand why I've never gotten very far in trying to explain to someone that marriage is a social institution and not a sacred institution.
Yeah. Right. You know, I mean, not too many years ago, you would have been burned at the stake for saying that. I mean, that's just blasphemy, you know, in some quarters. Okay.
Society early adopted the paying back attitude of retaliation. An eye for an eye, a life for a life. The evolving tribes all recognized the right of blood, vengeance. Vengeance became the aim of primitive life, but religion has since greatly modified these early tribal practices. The teachers of revealed religion have always proclaimed, "Vengeance is mine," says the Lord. Vengeance killing in early times was not altogether unlike present-day murders, under the pretense of the unwritten law.
What's an example of what they're talking about there at the end? You know, you will hear commonly honor killings. Right? And again, you notice it's, you know, when you're getting that taboo stuff, that sex stuff, right, or marriage things, where you have honor killing. So again, and go, oh, interesting historical tidbits. No. I mean, think about it. I mean, not only for you as an individual, but remember, we're well into the Enlightenment now, philosophically, right? You know, lack of wisdom, insight, and foresight ruling our civilization. Vengeance became the aim of primitive life. Think about how many people have fallen back into that. They dedicate their whole life to vengeance. That's, you know, it's primitive thinking. You know, it naturally manifests when you don't challenge yourself to be more than what you are by nature.
And then the entertainment industry will go ahead and glamorize that in their storytelling.
Of course. Right, like I told you, the ancient Greek philosophers bemoaned this, you know, in ancient times. You know, what's the storytellers do to eternalize this very animal-like mentality, this very primitive mentality? It's sad to record that there's very few people that even challenge such primitive thinking. You'll be demonized if you called it primitive. Are you calling me primitive? So here you see, you know, directly the eye for an eye, life for a life, like we could see they're hinting at up above. Notice that they, even though they're using the Bible again, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, the teachers of revealed religion have always proclaimed. So there's a little litmus test. When you look through, like Jesus and Gana did in the Library of Alexandria, you're looking through teachings of religionists, so-called religionists. Do they have the concept of vengeance is mine, says the Lord? Is there influence of revelation in their teachings, or is it all, natural human thought aggrandized? And that's kind of a funny one, too. Saying the vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I mean, that's Paul in the book of Romans paraphrasing the Old Testament, basically paraphrasing Mosaic, preachings. But so, the teachers of revealed religion, be they back literally in the Old Testament, when you're trying to get out of the blood vengeance thing and saying, no, you don't have the right to vengeance. That's God's right, not yours. Moses trying to lift it up out of the people and putting it in God, which is a step forward. But, you take a teacher of revealed religion, Paul, same. So there's a double revealer there between the lines, the way they did that.
Yeah, there's a close correlation between tribalism and this thought, because what Moses was trying to make a nation out of these
out of those tribes. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, you see it. Right? See, and you go, oh, wait a minute, we're slipping back in that. Yeah, we're losing our nation status. We're slipping back into tribal thought. And so there's all these things that are just natural to tribal thought. You'll have lots more and more tribalists dedicating their lives to vengeance. All right.
Suicide was a common mode of retaliation. If one were unable to avenge himself in life, he died entertaining the belief that, as a ghost, he would return and visit wrath upon his enemy. And since this belief was very general, the threat of suicide on an enemy's doorstep was usually sufficient to bring him to terms. Primitive man did not hold life very dearly. Suicide over trifles was common. But the teachings of the Dalmatians greatly lessened this custom, while in more recent times leisure, comforts, religion, and philosophy have united to make life sweeter and more desirable. Hunger strikes are, however, a modern analog of this old-time method of retaliation.
So the usual, I see. Hunger strikes are the same notion. If that hadn't occurred to you. But again, looking for the decay of more advanced cultural norms, like I was just repeating, pointing out before, to get back in this mode of employing suicide as a means of vengeance, okay. Even if you don't bring in the notion of, I'm gonna kill myself on your doorstep and come back as a ghost and bring wrath down on you. Even if we aren't superstitious like that, it's like, oh yeah, there's this perceived affront to what is right, so I'm gonna go blow myself up on your doorstep. Yeah, that's still in play, right? A primitive man did not hold life very dear. See just how primitive, again, that thinking is. Where, they're pointing out it's not just some reasonable religion and philosophy, in other words, that comes from a little bit more insight, but just leisure and comforts. So, so places where there aren't as many leisures and comforts, okay, see there, they're pointing out there is, that does feed that a little bit. That selfishness, It's like, well, I'm not gonna kill myself. I'm really enjoying the pleasures of the material comfort era. But if you're not selfishly enjoying the pleasures of the material comfort era, right, there's a tendency to go back to more primitive. See, so again, you can see the value in those selfish modes of the material comfort era. You don't want to demonize those. Those are better than something more primitive. You know? So again, they're trying to get you to reflect on the complexities of the evolutionary process. And they're also giving you a little hint there that you're falling back a long ways pre-Dalmatian. You know, if you're getting into that, it's we're talking very primitive. Yeah. It's sort of totally pre-revelatory. You know, the whole point of revelation is to begin to help humans to recognize their innate human value, right? To lift them up out of just thinking of themselves as yet another animal, you know, and seeing how ruthless nature is with, you know, animals just live and die in a blink of an eye, you know, and we're all just like that, and, you know, not seeing that as a human you have individuated value, you know, then the revelators come to try to encourage the recognition of that. Okay, anyway.
Kind of fun how that bell curve you always point out. It takes this kind of really span-rich revelatory input that goes back to pre the first revelation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Up to now, to match up with that broad spectrum of rehab.
We have just, it's so broad, you know, and they just, you know, they often remind you of just how broad it is like that. But, you know, just, you know, the final word that, you know, about hunger strikes, you know, you just, you know, you think about that mentality. I'll show you. I'll stop eating. All right? See? Yeah. But just see, again, it's like, well, okay, that, yeah, that's a pretty primitive mode of thought. You know, and so like you're pointing out, it's like, well, wait a minute, some of our most admired people have done that, and we laud this. Yeah, right, I mean, see, we all have to be very humble about where we are. We're a very primitive people still, you know. Some of the people that we hold up as the most enlightened are in very, very primitive states. Yeah, and so if they're enlightened, where are the rest of us? Yeah, it's all we seriously need to stop thinking that light and life is tomorrow. We got a long way to go.
Who on earth thinks that?
There are a lot of wide-eyed, you know, mystical people that, you know, think that. Anyway.
One of the earliest formulations of advanced tribal law had to do with the taking over of the blood feud as a tribal affair. But strange to relate, even then, a man could kill his wife without punishment, provided he had fully paid for her. The Eskimos of today, however, still leave the penalty for a crime, even for murder, to be decreed and administered by the family wronged.
You can probably see the point there. They're trying to, again, it starts out very subjective, and you're making definitive progress when some system is set up that demands greater objectivity, greater removal from the immediacy of the tension. Take it out of the hands of the two, aggrieved parties. Put it in. You know, depersonalize it as much as possible. Try to get it into the impersonal collective group judgment mode. You know, that eventually gets to humans building statues of Lady Justice, right, as a blindfold. Right? You know, because you have to get it out of that vengeance mode, that personal vengeance mode. Try to get it as objective as possible. And that's what's expected of us. We're expected to be trying our best to be objective, but we're not going to be condemned if we don't get very far. But we need to be trying. And again, it's slipping back. You know, we for a number of reasons. You know, some people, the whole bit of having law and an abstract justice system is just too abstract. They can really only wrap their minds around it if it's very mano a mano, right, if you will.
Yeah. Something that's occurring recently. Before it was the state versus so-and-so, the murderer, or the perpetrator, or the suspect. Mm-hmm. And the victims really didn't have a direct part to play unless it was as a witness, if they were alive. Mm-hmm. but now you have this phenomenon where the witnesses are brought in to express their feelings to the perpetrator. And I have an uneasy feeling about this. It's like it's slipping backwards. You know?
Yeah, right. See, again, it's becoming more and more subjectivity rather than an attempt to take all of the emotions out of it and deal with it objectively. And, I mean, one of the things that's making this problematic, there's more and more tendency, oh, if I take the emotions out of it, I'm going down. No. There's another way to take the emotions out of it besides going down. You can go up. Right? There are no feelings in the heart, the domain of objective thinking. Right? Your inner life, you get there by thinking, not by feeling. Right? And so just the fact that we're losing sight of that, you know, we think of feelings as the most exalted, you know, way that you could approach it, because we know nothing of that which is transcendent of feelings.
That makes sense. So the sense, this belief that this will be cathartic, is that?
Yeah.
That this will be a benefit to those expressing the... Probably not.
No, everything is decaying into, you know, basically a tribal sort of a mode, and...
So tonight you made a heartfelt appeal to just get rid of the feelings in the heart.
Do you have a piece of hair sticking straight? Just like a velvet hair.
So back to the paragraph here.
No pressure, Gene.
So
I'm not on camera.
Yeah. So why did they bring in the Eskimos of today? You know, remember they have, quite a bit of Andonite blood, right? So they're just pointing out that. You know, what happens naturally there, that they have a hard time getting to thinking abstractly enough to get from subjective to objective. And so they're just bringing, you know, reminding you of that. Okay, keep going.
Another advance was the imposition of fines for taboo violations, the provision of penalties. These fines constituted the first public revenue. The practice of paying blood money also came into vogue as a substitute for blood vengeance. Such damages were usually paid in women or cattle. It was a long time before actual fines, monetary compensation, were assessed as punishment for crime. And since the idea of punishment was essentially compensation, everything, including human life, eventually came to have a price, which could be paid as damages. The Hebrews were the first to abolish the practice of paying blood money. Moses taught that they should take no satisfaction for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death. He shall surely be put to death.
Right, so notice there that a life for a life is what he is putting forward. right, as the proper way to go about it and not get into this blood money thing. Now, again, notice basically a lot of the stuff they're saying, they're just repeating in different modes, reminding you how difficult it is for people to go to more abstract approaches. You know, they start out in very concrete, tangible modes. You know, like even getting to the point of actually using some sort of currency to pay a fine rather than something more immediate, like, you know, women or cattle. It's kind of the same story told over and over in many ways. This whole bit of the humans trying to progress to being able to take more abstract concepts seriously, you know, and subject themselves to them, or consider that you've done something real, you know, quote unquote, when you haven't actually paid in cattle, have you done anything real? Right? See, is there what initially thinking? So that's the, you know, and the only way, see, that you can have that ability to think more abstractly is working on your reflective thinking. So when it's sad to record, that means everything is going to fall back. It's going to have to be much more immediate, tangible modes of us dealing with each other, resolving differences between one another. Okay, let's see here. Anything else there? Maybe one little thing. Notice the tension between the lines. Taboo violations, fines for taboo violations. Okay, so taboos are about violating God's laws. God is good. Money's the root of all evil. See how you can get wrapped around the axle if you think about those modes. It just, you know. But, you know, as they're pointing, it's an advance to do the imposition of fines. But it, just giving you an example why it'd be difficult for humans to get there. You know, it's, you know, this thing that's so corrupting and is so man's construct, right, and hence evil, you know, in people's minds. Right, you know, that's not going to be an acceptable resolution of violating God's law. But we all know, and there's all kinds of things, crimes you can get where you don't go to jail, you get a fine. So eventually, you know, we got there.
Still a way of raising revenue.
Yes, yeah, not to mention they threw in that little element there. Yes, yeah, first public revenue. Okay.
Justice was thus first meted out by the family, then by the clan, and later on by the tribe. The administration of true justice dates from the taking of revenge from private and kin groups and lodging it in the hands of the social group, the state.
See, so notice they said true justice. See, again, what we've been building up to, going from very subjective things to as objective as possible. You know, so that there's this conformity to the whole, you know, so that it's true to some degree, the objective whole. Obviously, only reflective humans could get to those states, could challenge them that way. And they're bringing up that issue of the state, you know, so not just nation, but really pushing to state, territorial state, where you have laws instead of just mores. So the whole thing is they're just going to give you that, how all this works together in a system that you're trying to push forward. All right.
Punishment by burning alive was once a common practice. It was recognized by many ancient rulers, including Hammurabi and Moses, the latter directing that many crimes, particularly those of a grave sex nature, should be punished by burning at the stake. If the daughter of a priest or other leading citizen turned to public prostitution, it was the Hebrew custom to burn her with fire.
Okay, so, you know, they're reminding you, I mean, everyone knows about how prevalent it's been to punish various things by burning people at the stake, say. But the authorities behind this, it's like with, you know, primitive religion, intellectual assent, credulity, and established authority. You know, the way we will religiously submit ourselves to established authority. You know, you've got the heavy duties here, Hammurabi and Moses. You know, so in other words, basically, you know, for the last 4,000 years, you've had a very authoritative declaration that this is a very appropriate mode of meting out punishment. Now, the little thing that's not you know, present right here, but when you get to the evolution of religion papers, you know, later on here, in part three, they remind you about how potent a religious symbol fire has always been. Yeah, so when you put those two together, you know, you can understand, you know, why would, say, Moses put this forward as so definitively as the only way that, you know, because there's such, you know, those of a grave sex nature, and the way they said that, there is such a heavy weight of taboo violation here that you need very serious purifying to happen. Right? It is so thick with that which is evil that only the most potent purifying element, you know, and not only was fire treated as a revered symbol by almost everyone, but some, you know, taking it as far as literally thinking of it as deity itself. You know, so very pure, see, very, very potentially purifying. The only thing that could possibly cleanse us of this sin. See? So that's the thinking process behind, you know, those individuals codifying that as the punishment. Yeah.
Is there anything the guy did that was a crime of this nature?
You know, you got to remember that. You know, it was always one-sided. You know, back in those days. You know,
there was no taboo for the guy. You don't think?
I mean, there was some, but never, you know, it was, remember, they talk about this specifically in the marriage and family papers. I mean, there was always some on the male side, but never, you know, it was always very lopsided, you know. Females, you know, all had to do is blink, you know, improperly, and they were, you know, executed.
You see, we could be cleansed with water.
Women, you know, they needed the fire. Yeah. See,
just go take a bath.
Yeah. It took a long time for there to not be, you know, he's pointing out the problem, that for there not to be that bias of the severity, you know. The male could violate some, you know, moray or even taboo, but it just wasn't thought of as severe, and so a lesser thing, you know, could purify the tribe of this, you know, of this black spot. You know? Yeah, right? It's just, they're reminding you, and they said about, you know, paying in women and cattle. You know, that whole bit of treating women as property. I mean, it's just, you take your property very seriously, you know, and you value your property, and you detest the corruption of the value of your property. See, I mean, that's why it's, you know, why they're responding that way. Someone, was it you?
Well, the travesty for the men in this case, the priest or the leading citizen, if his daughter turns to prostitution, he loses face, he loses all. What will people think? I mean, he's demoted in the public eye.
Right.
So this is the only thing that'll cleanse him of this travesty.
Yeah, and remember, that gets back to the, you know, vengeance killing in early times was not altogether unlike present-day murders under the pretense of the unwritten law. Again, you know, why does, you know, is it believed that the father has the right to kill the daughter, say, you know, in an honor killing? Because the incredible loss of public face, you know, that the family is suffering at the hands of the daughter doing, violating the more system, you know, in one way or another. Right. It's just, you know, that you know, especially some cultures have always been very, very serious about losing public face.
Yeah, it's still going on, to a great extent, honor killings.
Yeah.
And it's not the men necessarily who are the enforcers. Women are often the enforcers of these.
Not the ones I've read about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're lucky you don't live in a Shiite culture, right?
Yeah. But like he's pointing out, you know, there's some bias about what we read about. You know, there's an agenda often in what, you know, what kind of honor killings are reported, you know, and you know, I mean, yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, it just, you know, between the lines of all this is, again, you know, when we think about honor killings today, you know, we're horrified, you know, and there's lots of desire to purge the earth of this, but again, it's an inescapable part of an evolutionary process, and you can try to artificially alter someone's culture, but you're most likely going to destabilize it. And remember, change without growth is potential evil. You know, you're forcing them to change in the name of goodness. But that's change without growth. So you're actually the agent of increasing the amount of evil on the earth. You know, it's so hard for us to think in evolutionary terms about this stuff. And again, because even if we don't think in taboos or think it's God's law, you know, you may have the most hopelessly secular person, but they're using their sixth adjutant, their religious impulse, to amp up their belief about how it's just innately wrong for this to be happening, and it must be changed at all cost. See, that's a disrespect of the evolutionary process. In universe terms, that's called rebellion. That's what rebellion is rejecting the inherent value of the evolutionary process and saying that we can just do things by fiat. Yeah. So
if you look around the world and you see the various stages of the evolutionary process, in this example, you can see them almost like this way back when, even today, and then, you know, in culture this may be advancing, you know, way beyond that. Is that the way you think it is on most planets, or are most planets probably all, once, you know, the Prince has been there, and Adam and Eve's there. They're all. It's all coming up as one, and it doesn't have so much differential as we do.
Yeah.
So it's difficult for us. You know, we sit here and we look at that and say, "Oh my God, what's wrong with these people?"
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, as you're saying, if we're in their shoes, we're sitting there and going, "Well, we're just going along normal the way we're supposed to."
Man. Yeah.
And yet, there's so much difference in our world. You think it's
No, you know, like I was stressing, on a normal world, you know, if like when you read those planetary mortal epics, right, the whole point is for each the the guides, if you will, of each dispensation to guide the people in a very tight grouping forward. Very slowly, but very methodically forward. And especially once you have Adam and Eve, what you're just saying, remember, their job is over like 25,000 years is to blend all the races into one race and eliminate all of the the really defective genetics and whatnot. See, which even further tightens up the bell curve, so that after Adam and Eve are done, you have a very, very narrow distribution that you move very methodically forward. But you know, we don't have that, and that's part of the challenge of doing right with your life on this world is to respect that it's not wrong that we have a broad distribution. It's just different from the norm.
Only that, everybody knows what everybody else is doing.
Yeah, and we have to try to somehow, it's going to be very difficult for us to find a way to have a world with a lot of harmony when there's such diversity like this. You know, we have, you know, because some of those very primitive forms, just they're not very compatible with more advanced civilization. I mean, they're fundamentally antisocial in the presence of a more advanced civilization. So, all right, how do you, and we can't compartmentalize anymore. We can't just have those primitive people stay in that region of the globe, you know, like they used to. Now, you know, now the ants are just swarming all over the ball. So, you know, it's difficult.
But we kind of have an opportunity, though, to see that it's not the primitiveness that's the problem, it's the direction it's going. Mm-hmm. You have a primitive situation over here that's progressing forward.
Yeah.
Might have an advanced situation over here that's regressing backwards.
Right.
It's not so important where you are, it's which direction you're headed.
Yes, it is. And you know, the revelators try to point that out. Yeah, I mean, and I try to stress that a lot. I mean, if I have to pick between two factually similar primitive states, I pick the one that's going slowly forward, not the one that's slowly going backward. The magic man is going forward. Magic matter is going backward. All right? You know, especially those that are going backward with a lot of will behind it. And not just material gravity isn't sort of dragging them backward unwittingly. There's some willful driving of it backwards. Right? There is no natural pre-primitive man. Right? The first man is primitive. To get pre-primitive, like many of us today, that's unnatural. That's a result of a very unfortunate exercise of will. Right, to drive yourself actually into a worse state. Yeah, and like you're just stressing, it's bad enough that you're going backward, but then factually when you go backward so far that you're pre-beginning, now you got some serious emergency situation, you know, in place on the planet.
Jesus did have to confront that problem to some degree on a personal level. Level, he found where the person was and always pointed him in the direction of eternity.
Right, but what you're bringing out, a key point there. I mean, you have a lot of potential to deal with that diversity on a one-to-one basis. But we have to be very humble about the collective phenomenon. You know, like Jesus, you know, again, Jesus' example. I mean, by and large, you just let that be. And he tried to encourage others to let the big picture, you know, the collective phenomenon just, you know, be what it is. Because, again, technically, if you think that you're going to try to take your sense and impose it upon the masses in defiance of the evolutionary process, that's rebellion, right? That's revolution. And revolution is never appropriate, you know, as an outer life phenomenon. You know, if there's going to be revolution, it has to be confined to just your inner life. And the domain where you're sovereign. And if you want to turn yourself on a dime, that can be good. But if you try to take that to the outer life, that's change without growth, that's potential evil. You know, but you're sovereign in there. You have free will. If you want to turn your life around in your inner life just like that, that's fine. Yeah. But you know, we just, you know, the problem is when you externalize it and you're trying to demand that, you know, these people that have, say, a primitive idea about the relationship between men and women, it's like, well, I want you to change tomorrow, or I'm never going to talk to you again. I'm going to impose all kinds of, you know, monetary pressure on you or whatever, economic pressure on you. I mean, we have to respect the evolutionary process more. But the more spiritually consciousness we become, right, the more impatient we become. You know, we don't want to wait. You know, a lot of times if you just, you know, if you just do a great job of being a better example of the relationship between men and women over here in your country, give it a few decades and that other country will pick up on it. You know, you'll act like the spirit of truth, you know, and accelerating, catalyzing their evolutionary process. But just be patient, you know, 50 years and it'll be better. It's like, no, I want it to be better tomorrow. Right? What do we want? Change in Saudi Arabia. When do we want it now? You know, that's just very silly. I pick your example, but
take your example.
Yeah,
I was teasing.
All right, let's see. Let's keep going here so we can finish up.
Treason, the selling out or betrayal of one's tribal associates, was the first capital crime. Cattle stealing was universally punished by summary death, and even recently, horse stealing has been similarly punished. But as time passed, it was learned that the severity of the punishment was not so valuable a deterrent to crime as was its certainty and swiftness.
You know, I mean, that's the big issue with capital punishment. You know, these days is it's the antithesis of certain and swift, and hence it's, you know, really pointless then.
Or any punishment.
Yeah, or any punishment for that matter. Let you know, but all the more so with capital punishment. Yeah, you know, as they're pointing out here. And of course, you know, what's the only crime in the Constitution? You know, that's punishable by death. It's treason. And all you've done with the word treason is just give it a very precise definition in the Constitution instead of just a sort of a arbitrary subjective thing. Well, I declare that that's treason and you die, you know, like it was in the old days. You know, they tried to get it more objective and definitive. Let's see, anything else that we need to... Yeah, the one little thing between the lines there is reminding you of how long it took before the horse became a significant phenomenon. I remember the other places in the book, we've, you know, they talk about that. You know, cattle were there very early on, but it actually took a while for the horse to become become enculturated, sort of, right? All right, then the final little thing here.
When society fails to punish crimes, group resentment usually asserts itself as lynch law. The provision of sanctuary was a means of escaping this sudden group anger. Lynching and dueling represent the unwillingness of the individual to surrender private redress to the state.
Okay, so that final thought has kind of been between the lines here a little bit as we've been reading. You know, the more that you take things out of the immediate hands of the issue, you know, and take it to the larger and larger groups, you know, and having it be more and more abstract because of that, you bring into play this phenomenon. You know, if the big group moves too slowly and you're very impatient, right, you want it to go back to the good old days where you just took care of this yourself. And then, of course, the other thing is not just the slowness, you know, where you have to have some patience when you go to the bigger group like this, but you can start to get corruption. And, you know, see, when society fails to punish crimes, right, and, you know, we are certainly having to deal with that more and more. You know, because when you go to this more abstract state of laws, you know, you've got clever people that can manipulate things then, you know, because it's out of that more immediately tangible space. And frustration is going to build. There's a huge responsibility on those who are in charge of overseeing the application of law, you know, the administrators of justice, to be very integrous. If that breaks down, you can, you know, I mean, that's a spark that's going to become a raging flame in very short order and just burn down the whole social contract. So that's a very ominous thing. You know, if the justice system begins to lose its integrity, or if people even think, I mean, maybe it isn't objectively losing its integrity totally, but if people believe that it is, it's all going to fall apart. I mean, so, like I said, the responsibility in the hands of those who are the administrators of justice to be beyond reproach and to be very transparent and to make sure that everyone is with them and suspicions aren't, you know, developing. You know, I don't have to explain to you that obviously that's breaking down. See, and again, that's part of the emergency. That's a part of the collapse of civilization that's going on. The second fall of Rome, as it were. So between the lines there. And just notice, too, I mean, the corruption. The provision of sanctuary was a means of escaping this sudden group anger. Sanctuary is against vigilantism. Sanctuary, it's not a sanctuary, it's a sanctuary from vigilantism, not a sanctuary from the law. See the corruption there that we see these days, using that word sanctuary. And it's like, well, why did it get corrupted like that? Well, it's because you don't think that you've decided that the whole so-called law, the whole legal system, is all just arbitrary vigilante justice. See, the social contract is breaking down. You can just see it in the words that we instinctually use to describe what we're up to, as they're trying to point out here. Okay? You're falling back into those primitive modes. But like Gene was saying, it's worse than before. Because before they were going forward, now we're in that state going backward. Yeah. Okay, so that's where they go next is you know, getting to law in courts and, you know, trying to set up that that more objective institution and having the people challenged to have the integrity to populate that system and to respect that system. So we'll,
Tackle that next year.
We'll tackle that the next time we get together, yes. Let's take a moment here and just to try to see if we can find that inner human nature that can stay going forward and not join the masses going backward.